and strong reel too. Can you tell me what type of personal services the bearer actually did for you in your case?
Yes, right. Mohammed Bakhsh, bearer. I think he's a marvellous bloke. Personal services, he was very much my personal servant. He did everything in the bungalow that I told him to do, but so far as myself. All right, early morning, he'd bring my early morning tea and tea for my wife. Then when I got up, I'd go into the ghusl khana, which is the bathroom, as you call it in England, and do my dump there. That was shut off from my dressing room. I'd then come back into the dressing room and start to wash, shave, and dress. There'd be hot water for me for my shaving in a mug on the table where the basin is. We had no flush system there. The water was supplied, hot water the bearer would get from the beastie who'd heat it up, and all the water in the debby in the 4 gallon tin, cold water, would be provided by the bearer, by the beastie, sorry. I'd wash and shave. Then I'd start to dress. Putting on uniform. All my uniform would be laid out, the khaki shirt all ironed and starched, the khaki shorts, very much starched, ironed, creased on the front of them, puttees, boots, polished, socks. That's about all one wore in the hot weather, actually. So the first thing that happened, I put on my shorts, I'd take off my pajama trousers, put on my shorts. In this particular case, he didn't assist me. If I had to wear trousers, changing into mufti or changing evening dress or even wearing khaki drill trousers, he would hand me the trouser, the waist, the waistband, which I'd take from him. He'd then bend over and take hold of the bottom of my trousers where the crease was and hold them off the ground so I didn't, at getting at the trousers, I didn't dirty the trousers on the floor. He would very discreetly look to the side as I had stepped into my trousers, and when I was in, all well, good, he'd then get up and attend to the next thing. He might be handing me my shirt, or handing me a tie, or handing me a handkerchief, or handing me a jacket, and so on. When I was dressed, he'd then disappear and get breakfast ready. The breakfast would have been, of course, laid by the masalchi, or else by Mohammed Bakhsh, the bearer. My wife would be in her ghusl khana, her bathroom dressing. She wasn't privileged to have anyone assist her, any maid servant, anything like that. We then walk out. Breakfast was always on the dot. If I said 8 o'clock breakfast was ready at 8 o'clock, and we were expected to be there at 8 o'clock. We'd sit down, and Mohammed Bakhsh would then serve breakfast to us, or the masalchi would serve breakfast to us. Clear away, we get up from the table, and Mohammed Bakhsh would arrange for the table to be cleared and taken outside. The chokra, the young fellow, would probably help washing up just to see, get trained in what the duties were in the way of cleaning the crockery, etc. Mohammed Bakhsh would then see that my helmet, my Sam Brown belt, were ready for me to put on, and I'd go off on parade. He would then supervise the cleaning and looking after the bungalow, seeing that the sweeper did his job, seeing the bathrooms all cleaned out, all the dirty water emptied down the open drains. There weren't any sinks, any drainage systems then in most of the compounds and bungalows. I don't know, in the big towns like Calcutta, of course, they had drains in which you could empty things. But a lot of stuff, water, for instance, would be taken out and emptied on the lawns, trying to keep the grass going there. Having done that, he would then disappear for a while where he'd get his own food. And that was understood that when he went to get his food, everything stopped. He wasn't expected to come out in the middle of eating his food and do some job. It was his own private time, and he ate his food. When he'd eaten his food, he might just hang about, or he'd probably go to my wife and see if there's anything she wanted. If she wanted something from the canteen, he might be employed to get it. More often than not, actually, my wife would go to the canteen, accompanied probably by Mohammed Bakhsh Bera, who'd carry anything like that. Or if my wife was going down to the bazaar, he'd arrange for a tonga to come along. That's the pony trap, a special thing in India, horse cart, you might say, with springs, rather. He would sit beside the driver of the tonga and direct him where to go. My wife got out of the tonga into a shop. He'd accompany her and have a basket and put the item she bought into the basket and bring it back to the tonga. And then when she'd come back to the bungalow, he'd arrange to take the stuff. Food would go to the kitchen, or anything she'd bought in the way of clothing and that, my wife would take into the bungalow with herself. Then Mohammed Bakhsh would probably have a bit of a rest, nothing to do, I mean, and prepare for lunch. Lunch was always at a certain time, 1 o'clock, shall we say. Table was laid, the cook had prepared the lunch that had been ordered by my wife, either through Mohammed Bakhsh, the bearer, or by direct order to the bawachi, the cook. I'd come back from the office, parade. I'm talking at the time I was in Faizabad and an adjutant, when most of my work, of course, was in the office, not all of it. I'd come back at, generally as punctually as I could, because it was a little upsetting to the servants if everything was laid on, then master didn't turn up for another half hour or so. But they faced all those difficulties without any real trouble. After lunch, I'd go back to the office. My wife would probably sit, read, sew, something like that, and Mohammed Bakhsh would disappear into the servants' quarters. And I don't know what he did there, slept probably, I don't know, no idea at all. Tea was the next item, which Mohammed Bakhsh supervised. He'd bring tea in on the tray to, shall we call it, the drawing room, the living room. We'd have our tea there. And probably by then, after tea, I was going to change, go up to the club, play tennis, or I might be going off to play cricket, or I might be off for some game with the battalion, the troops, and like that. And so I warned him, and he'd have the necessary clothing laid out on my chair. I didn't throw my clothes about ever on the floor or anything like that, but if they had been, he'd just pick them up, and everything I'd worn that morning in the way of uniform would be put aside, ready for the beastie, and not the beastie, I'm sorry, the dobi, to collect next morning, take off, wash, and return. I'd always warn him if we were going out to dinner that night, otherwise he'd know. Dinner in the bungalow, I'd come in from playing a game to the club, wherever it may be, a bath would be ready for me, and evening clothes. We always changed at night time then, and put on either white dinner jacket if the weather was very hot, very seldom a black one, it was normally a white one when you were down on the plains, and we'd have our dinner, whatever hour it was ordered. After that, Mohammed Bakhsh would see everything is tidied up in the bungalow and washed up, etc. And just before we went to bed, he'd pray at the doorway and salam and say good night. Well, that was his way of saying good night, just salam. And next morning, the usual routine. He'd bring me tea and my wife tea in the early morning, whatever time we'd ordered it, and so on. Day after day, same routine. If anything cropped up, we were going away. He would pack up. I might have to tell him any particular item I wanted to be packed up when I was going away, but normally he knew exactly what I wanted, shirts I wanted, socks I wanted, ties I wanted, etc., etc. There was one little thing about the bearer. Bearers normally were fundamentally always honest, especially with our own master, their own sahib. It was a custom in India, you had very little coin, you had mostly notes or no money at all, and just signed chits and that. But it was a custom, if you had any cash notes, very often people used to put that money under the paper lining of your top drawers, of your chest drawers, right-hand drawer, left-hand drawer. It was done. I think everyone knew it. Or certainly all the thieves knew where the money was. But occasionally, very, very occasionally, the bearer would possibly extract, there might be 20 rupees there, he might extract one or two rupee notes and put it under the paper cover, paper lining of a drawer down below, or two drawers below of your chest of drawers. And then, being very crafty, he might next day or the day after say, "Oh, Saab, look, I found this money lying about. Didn't you know?" He said, and you say, "No, I didn't know." "Well, here it is, Saab. You left it lying about." It's obvious that you hadn't missed the full quantity of money you put under the paper of your top drawer, of your chest of drawers. Having learnt that lesson, he realized that Master wasn't very careful about how much money he put on the paper. He would then, months later, a week later, so on, take some money again from the, underneath the paper in your top drawer and put it in the paper in the second or third drawer, you see. And after a fortnight, nothing being said, you hadn't missed any money and you hadn't retrieved the money that had been hidden, he'd quietly pouch it and take it. That is only one of these things that happened in India. It wasn't a common practice by any means. I couldn't imagine ever Mohammed Bakhsh having done this, but one learnt about these habits from the mere fact that people had experienced this similar treatment.
Did you ever come across any serious attempts at corruption in India?
No, I can't say I did, because corruption. You see, we in the army had very little to do with the businessman. All we had was the contractor. We had a fellow called Niaz Ahmed who was a contractor. He was responsible for running the, what we call in England, NAFE, the canteen. He would be responsible for getting you an elephant if you ordered one. He'd be responsible for hiring a car or buying a car, could be responsible for getting a car for you. He would rarely get anything you wanted. And that was his job as contractor. As adjutant, I suppose I was open for bribery, shall we say, by someone. I never experienced it. At Christmas, the contractor always gave, I think always gave everyone, every officer, some form of present. It was generally a basket of fruit of some description. And it had been known that sometimes in your basket of fruit, there might be a 100 rupee note or 200 rupee note. Obviously, he was hoping to get something out of you by this little gift of money. If it was discovered, I think, judging from my experience of my knowledge, I put it that way, I think if it was discovered, he'd have got an awful thick year, the contractor would, from the commanding officer or the adjutant, and I don't think he'd have tried it again. So I can fairly say I had no experience of corruption. I don't say it didn't happen between civilian contractors and building contractors or road contractors, anything, but I don't know. I really hadn't met it.
Was there not an occasion which you told me about in which a Havildar gave you a present of some
clothes? Oh, yes, yes. After a while, I got a job up in the frontier, staff captain of the Manzai Brigade. And from Manzai, we moved up to Wana Plain when it was decided to reoccupy the plain which had been bordering on Afghanistan. I had there a Sikh Havildar sergeant who was the sergeant in charge of my Prevost establishment, the brigade Prevost staff who had odd duties in the camp, of course. A nice fellow. Just for Christmas one day, he came into my office and brigade headquarters with a brown paper parcel and said, "Saab, this is a Christmas present for you. Salaam, Saab, a Christmas present for you." And I said, "What is this? What is?" "Oh," he said, "it's only a cloth for your wife so she can make a dress. And I said, well, look, Helder, I'm afraid I never receive any presents. And he was a little upset about this. Well, he said, may I just leave it here? I said, all right. And he put it on the table on the side in the office and left it there. It wasn't really, I'm thinking it over later, I suppose I made a bit of a mistake. It wasn't money or anything like that. I've confessed I didn't even look inside the parcel what sort of material it was. But I thought I oughtn't to take it. And I feel now, a long, long time afterwards, he really didn't mean it in any form of bribery. I think he was rather hurt I'd made this mistake and worked on the principle that I was in a staff job, I was in a responsible position, I had authority over certain people, that it might have had some after purpose. He might have hoped to get something out of me later on. So I'm sorry to say now, I did refuse it, and I felt poor old Heveldor was a bit hurt about it. I can't say that I have any knowledge of these sort of things happening. They must have happened, and they did happen, because it happens all over the world, and the Indians know the value of presentation, they know the value of good feeling between people, that sort of thing. There it is. I've made a mistake, I think, and I don't think any great harm came out of it. Whereas I was frightened that harm might come out of it if I had accepted it.
Did you and your wife make any close Indian friends whilst you were in India?
Close Indian friend, no. We didn't really come in contact with Indian population. At the, for instance, Rawalpindi, the barracks there were right away from the cantonment where the Indians lived. Up in the frontier, of course, there weren't any Indians, civilians about. No close friends. We made friends occasionally with Indians, but no close friends were. They went. They came up to your bungalow and during the morning, your wife talked and had a cup of coffee or something like that, or we'd go to tea there. Now, in those days, I have no recollection in our battalion or even in the brigade when I was in brigade staff of close friendships. But the reason I think, really, because Lahore, out of cantonment, we weren't close to the town. Rawalpindi, we weren't close to the town. Faizabad, in fact, no civilians anywhere there at all. I don't think there was the opportunity, really, to make close friendship with the Indian families.
Did you get out into the local towns very much?
No.
Or was your life mostly confined to the cantonment?
No, we didn't. By and large, your life was really confined to the cantonment where the troops were stationed. One could go for leave, of course, wherever you liked, but I don't think the opportunities were very, very present. See, our trouble, I think, was that in a British battalion, very few of us indeed, spoke Hindustani. A certain number of the Indians spoke English, but we didn't really get the chance of mixing with them. I was in Calcutta for a very, very short time before I went out to Mesopot, and possibly the battalion there may have had more opportunity, but on the other hand, there was quite a large English population in Calcutta, and I think they had more contact with the army than the Indians did. It may be very different now. I'm talking years and years ago, 40 years ago or so.
Did you ever feel uneasy as you went about in the local towns on the occasions that you did?
No. I don't think I ever feared for one's safety. I believe once, my wife did say once when she was driving under Tonga in Faizabad, someone threw a brick at Tonga, and I think Mohammed Bux leapt out of the Tonga, and I don't know what happened, but anyhow, the brick didn't hit the Tonga, or didn't hit my wife. But I never ever heard of a similar occasion, a similar thing happening. Most unusual. No unease at all. One's wife could go into the bazaar quite safely, I think.
How did that come about, this brick being thrown at the Tonga?
Well, I don't know how it came about. I believe, some young fellow thought he was being brave or thought he was expressing some indignation. There was no repercussion of it. It just so happened, see. She doesn't know why it happened, and I don't think Mohammed Bux ever really troubled to find out or anything like that. It just did happen. It didn't hit the Tonga, but someone did throw a brick. That's all I can tell you, really. And it didn't stop my wife going into the bazaar at all. It simply passed over, so we didn't think more about it, really.
Coming on to the work that you did in India, can you tell me about your time on the frontier and the work which you were involved in there?
Right. Well, I was then stationed in Rawalpindi with the battalion, East Surrey Regiment, and an officer in the Indian Army who had been brigade major at Manzai on the frontier near Dera Ismail Khan said, look, I believe the staff captain of the Manzai Brigade is nearly finished his time in command. Would you like a job like that? And I said, yes, very much indeed. And he wrote up to the brigade commander there and said that Armstrong was down here and I know him and that sort of thing. And he'd very much like take over a staff captain job up there. And that's how it came about in due course, not very long, a month or so. I was told to report to brigade headquarters in Manzai, just over the Indus River, near Dera Ismail Khan, D-I-K as we called it then. And I took over from this fellow. He's also a British officer in the... the Light Infantry Regiment, I can't remember now which one. That started my four-year job on the frontier. After a while, interesting job, I liked it very much indeed. After a while, the authorities, shall we say, Commander-in-Chief India, that sort of thing, they decided that they would reoccupy the Warna Plain, which had been vacated, I think, during the war or so on. There had been troops up there, and this was the plain between, shall we say, India and parts of Afghanistan. Well, it was about a 5 or 6 day march from Manzai to Warna. On the way up there, we had camps, about 4 or 5 camps, which we occupied each night, perimeter camps. I think we did about 12 mile marches each day. And we got onto the Warna Plain, and then I had to set out the permanent camp that the brigade would occupy when we got there. Do you want any more about it? Well, when we approached Warna, I had to rush ahead with representatives from each unit in the brigade, not only the battalions, but also the transport, the pioneers, the signalers, the armored car section. We had 4 armored cars, old decrepit things rather, with solid tires. Indian Army Service Corps, rations, etc. And the mule company. We had about 800 mules, of course, because all the stuff was carried when you were out on column, on active work, on mules. and a certain amount of mule transport was also used. So I had to rush round, measure out campsites, and let the troops in before it got dark. When you occupy a camp like that, the brigade major and brigade commander, one of the first things they do is to look at the safety of the camp by putting out what we call pickets. Pickets generally were put on the commanding ground to prevent the enemy, you might say, or people who wanted to have a snipe at you or attack you from getting an opportunity of doing so. In our area up there, there were Waziris, which are from Waziristan, southwest Waziristan, where we were in. And dawn next day, the troops started to build their perimeter wall. You had around your camp a wall of about 5 foot high from stones, stones everywhere in India up there. And that enabled the troops to keep be under cover whilst they were in the camp in case of attack. It was walls sufficiently high to stop a man getting wounded if he wished to crouch down, and not too high to prevent the average soldier being able to fire over the perimeter at any attacking force. If there was any prominent high ground within rifle range of the camp, as there was in this case, there was high ground we called Gibraltar Picket. You occupied that to prevent the enemy getting up there during the night time and sniping at the camp. There were always a certain number of bad men, shall we say, who'd like to have a plug at you. And generally the poor people who got the bullet were the mules, because there was about 800 mules in a solid mass. And they generally end up with one or two of them was a stray shot in the backside, but they seemed to survive all right. The vet extract the bullet and that. So for the next month, you might say, 100% energy was building the camp, perimeter. That was most important, and just one or two entrances to the camp, wide enough to let transport and motor cars out in one or two cases, but normally the entrance to the camp was so arranged that only the odd man could get in and out. Each unit occupying the frontier, occupying the perimeter wall, was responsible for the defense of that sector of the camp. Let me think now. This went on for a long time, of course. Then we got tents up very quickly. We all had then the 80-pound, 160-pound, a small tent to live in. But after a short time, they started sending us up the IP tent, the big square tent, which was much more comfortable for the troops. Eventually, the next summer, this was in the summer that we went and occupied the camp. That first winter we lived in the small 80-pounder, 160-pounder tents. Next summer we got the big IP tents, as we call it, the big square tent, and put those up. And then the next job was to build mud walls around these tents to make them warmer for the troops in winter. Water supplies had to be arranged and guarded. After second summer, we could arrange for sort of gardens to be apportioned to each unit where they could grow vegetables they want. This was outside the camp perimeter, so they could only be occupied or used, et cetera, to start with, where they were in a position which was defensible or could be defended by the pickets placed out during daylight. Actually, in this particular camp, we were lucky that Gibraltar Picket was very much a commanding post which overlooked the gardens and saved the men who happened to be employed there from being sniped at either by day. But at night time, of course, everyone came inside the perimeter except those on permanent picket duty. Then, as we got more civilized, we had tennis courts, we had a ride in